Today I speak to Professor Gilad Zuckerman, a fellow polyglot. He is originally from Israel and lives in Adelaide, Australia, where he is a professor of linguistics and endangered languages at the University of Adelaide. He helps Aboriginal Australians to reclaim their heritage language, which means to learn it. He also teaches the free online course, Language Revival, Securing the Future of Endangered Languages, which already had over 10,000 participants from over 160 countries. Gilad, so glad to have you on.
Thank you, Gabriel. It's wonderful talking to you.
So first, I'm really interested. This is a pretty interesting topic there that you're doing research in, that you're working on, which is not very common. Why did you decide to go study endangered languages, and why did you decide to help people reclaim their heritage languages?
Well, first I have to say how I decided to become a linguist, because I became a linguist before delving into endangered languages. I believe it was an inhibition in the oral phase. You know, from a very early stage in my life, I was very attracted to languages, to various languages, to differences between languages, to how to write palindromic stories. So it was kind of a ludic or a playful attraction to languages from a very early stage. I met my girlfriend of 7, 8 years old recently, and she said, oh, I knew in Kita Aleph, which is the first grade, that you were a professor of linguistics. I said, what? I mean, this is crazy. Well, she knew. At a very early stage, I was very much into mathematics, but I felt that there was no heart as much as there is in the case of language and language speakers. So I eventually became a linguist. And then one day, I was at Cambridge, at the University of Cambridge in England. I was on a sabbatical at the university in Singapore, National University of Singapore, and I was invited to Australia to give a public lecture at the University of Sydney. I arrived in Sydney and fell in love with Australia. I really enjoyed the beauty, the spectacularity of Sydney, etc. And then I decided to move from England to Australia. And upon arrival in Australia in 2004, after writing a lot about the Hebrew revival, which, you know, my mother tongue is what I call Israeli, I asked myself, okay, now I'm in Australia. This was my dream at the time. What can I do here? How can I contribute towards the Australian society that was so, you know, so welcoming? So I identified two problems in Australia. One is bureaucracy. I mean, Australia is really, it's not a democracy. You know, some countries are aristocracies, countries are democracies. Israel, where I was born, is an adhocracy. You know, it's everything is ad hoc. But Australia, for me, is a bureaucracy ab initio. So modern Australia was established as a bureaucracy. You had convicts and their administrators. You had free settlers and their governors, you had Aboriginal people and their protectors. Everything was bureaucratic. And Australia today is a professionalized bureaucracy due to the Americanization and, you know, the officialization of bureaucracy. So I said, this is the first problem of Australia. But as an intellectual, what can I do? I can just swallow the bitter pill, so to speak. So there is nothing to do. What is the second problem, I asked myself? And then I recognized, I identified that there was a very huge problem that has to do with the Australian past. And this is the Aboriginal problem. And I said to myself very clearly, had I been a dentist, I would have given, you know, pro bono dental treatments to Aboriginal people, because many Aboriginal people, unfortunately, do not have teeth. I shouted an Australian Aboriginal friend of mine for a steak, you know, shouted meaning I treated her, I paid for a steak, I invited her for a steak, and at the end I gave her a toothpick, and then she said, what is this? I said, you know, this is a toothpick for the steak. She said, I don't have any teeth, and then I realized that she didn't have any teeth. I didn't even know when I offered her a steak. She just ate with the gums. It was very interesting. So had I been a dentist, I would have treated Aboriginal teeth. Had I been a psychologist, I would have helped Aboriginal people to get out of smoking. Almost every Aboriginal person I work with is a smoker. Almost every non-Aboriginal person I work with at the University of Adelaide is a non-smoker. So there is a very clear distinction in my life, in my daily life here, between Aboriginal smokers and non-Aboriginal non-smokers. But I am a linguist, and at the time, in 2004, I was an expert of the Hebrew Revival. So I decided to dedicate my time to assisting Aboriginal people with reconnecting with their heritage languages that were unfortunately subject to linguicide, to killing. I mean, Aboriginal languages, unfortunately, were killed by colonization, were killed by the stolen generations. So out of 330 Aboriginal languages, you only have 13 that are alive and kicking. So 4% are alive and kicking, which means spoken by all the children of the tribe. 96% of Aboriginal languages are either sleeping beauties or dreaming beauties. Sleeping beauty is a term that I coined with regard to Israeli, or actually with regard to Hebrew, not Israeli, the sleeping beauty of Isaiah, because nobody spoke Hebrew for 1,750 years. But dreaming beauties is a term that I use for Australia because of the Jukurpa, the dream time, the dreaming. So dreaming beauties are languages that are no longer spoken. So if I come back to the point is that out of 330 Aboriginal languages, approximately, that we had in time of contact in the 19th century, only 4% are alive and kicking. 96% are either sleeping beauties or dreaming beauties, or are about to fall asleep, to become sleeping beauties.
So do you
This is how.
okay, and so do you help to revive the beauties, or do you help with the languages that are still alive, the 4%?
That's a very good point. So, language revival, as I see it, and this is what I discuss a lot in revivalistics, which is a new transdisciplinary field of inquiry, is on a continuum of reclamation. Reclamation is the most severe case. For example, Hebrew, no native speakers in 1886, until 1886, and after 135 AD, nobody speaks Hebrew as a mother tongue. Bangala, nobody speaks the Bangala Aboriginal language of Eyre Peninsula, South Australia, after 1960. It is killed by stolen generation policies. So this is reclamation. Then you have revitalization in the middle, which is a language that has elders like Adnyamatna in the Flinders Ranges, even Maori, to the extent that unfortunately only 4% of Maori in New Zealand speak fluent Maori. So it is revitalization. It has elders that speak it, but it's very endangered. And then you have reinvigoration, which is like Welsh and Irish, languages that have many speakers, but still I would regard them as endangered. So on this continuum, I decided personally, because one has to focus on something, I decided to focus on the reclamation, which is the hardest case or the most severe case, because you have no native speakers to listen to. You only have material, hopefully, sometimes material written by German Lutheran missionaries. For example, in the case of Bangala, I use a dictionary written in 1844 by Clamor Wilhelm Schumann, who was born not far from Osnabrück in Bissendorf. I have been there not long ago, I mean last year in 2017, and saw the room where Clamor Wilhelm Schumann was born in. He wanted to Lutheranize, to Christianize the Aboriginal kind of the Aboriginal people who were not Christian, obviously. And in order to do that, he translated. He wanted to translate the Bible, but actually he just wrote a dictionary of the Bangla language for religious reasons. And now, 175 years later, I, a secular Jew, use this religiously written document in order to help Aboriginal people to reconnect with her past that was unfortunately was disconnected due to missionary activities and stolen generations. So in fact, you're talking here about a UNESCO enterprise of everybody comes together. And what is beautiful here in this writing, The Wrong of the Past, is that we use a dictionary written 175 years ago for a totally different goal, So practically, I tell people the lesson here is that you do things today, you have no idea how they will be useful and beneficial in 175 years. And this might be applicable to any other field, not just to my field. So this is a beautiful writing The Wrong of the Past. The other thing about writing The Wrong of the Past, about this twist, is that I use technology, or what I call talknology. So for example, an app. So we've made an app out of this dictionary revised. And I use technology or talknology, talk and technology together, in order to reconnect with this heritage that was unfortunately killed by technology. I mean, the colonizers came by technology, by ships. The colonized, the stolen generation people, they stole the children with a black car. They came with a black car, which is technology, and stole the children from, kidnapped their children from their mothers, etc. So we use technology in a totally different way. This is the twist that I like in this historic development of language revival.
Okay. That brings out two questions. And it's two issues that I know the people reviving Hebrew or Israeli, as you call it, had. And I'm interested how you solve these two problems. And maybe you can talk about how the settlers in early Palestine solved these problems, which is, first is accent, and second is missing words. So like, I know with Hebrew, with modern Hebrew, it's like they use the roots to create new words. And with the accent, well, I'm not quite sure how they solve this. So maybe you can talk about how you solve this problem with what is it called? Bangala
has two retroflexes. Bangala. The N is a retroflex, so you put your tongue up, bang, like the Indians do.
Bang.
Bang. And then gara with a ra.
Bangara. Bangara.
Yeah. Like a chicken tikka, you know, when you go to an Indian restaurant, you wonder chicken tikka, okay. It's not tikka, tikka. So this is a retroflex.
Yeah.
Bangala.
Bangala. So now, how do you solve these problems? And maybe you can talk about how it was solved with Israeli.
Well, that's a wonderful question, a very perspicacious one, but my answer might shock you. Firstly, The first problem was not solved in the Israeli case. So when an Israeli speaks Israeli, what I call Israeli or reclaimed Hebrew, by and large, his or her pronunciation reflects the Germanic language called Yiddish. So the intonation of Israelis, the pronunciation that they have for the consonants, for example, tz instead of so, for example, k instead of to, for example, t instead of po, for example, r instead of r, for example, nothing instead of ah, for example, nothing instead of like a glottal stop, for example, nothing instead of ha, reflects Yiddish, because in Yiddish you do not have the pharyngealized consonants or the pharyngeal like po, o, so, like you have in Arabic. For example, my Yemenite friend in Israel, his grandmother and his grandfather, when they talk about meatball, they say "tesiso," "tesiso." But when we talk about meatball, we say "ktsitsa," "ktsitsa." Mm-hmm. We are actually violating the syllable structure of Hebrew, because in Hebrew you could never put two consonants at the beginning. "Ktsitsa" is against the syllable structure of Hebrew. In Hebrew, not in Israeli, after the first consonant, you must have a vowel. And then you can have either a consonant and a vowel, and then you can have an optional consonant. So, for example, ekdach means not obviously a pistol, like it means today, a kdach. It's pronounced a kdach. There is no consonant at the beginning. Kdach, kdach. You know, it's just E-K. It's not eh, it's a kdach. But in Hebrew, a kdach, you had to have the glottal stop that you have in German. Er ist ein Mann. Yeah, you must have, you cannot say er ist ein Mann. Er ist ein Mann. Er ist ein Mann, you know. But in Israeli, we don't have this. Now, in Hebrew, ekdach meant some kind of an expensive stone or a precious stone or whatever. But we changed the meaning for various reasons. Like the root has to do with drilling, like a drill of bullets or something like that. So the point I'm trying to make here is that the consonant inventory, the intonation, the syllable structure, even the phonology of Israeli reflect Yiddish rather than Hebrew. So we did not solve this issue in the case of Israeli. Mm-hmm. And I predict that any reclamation attempt, especially reclamation rather than reinvigoration, revitalization and reinvigoration, must recognize that you will never be able to speak the original language as it used to be, mm-hmm. especially when it comes to phonetics and phonology, especially when it comes to mindset, to discourse, to communication style. You will not be able to reclaim the sleeping beauty elements. You will have to resort, unfortunately, under the current technological phase, it might change, you will need to resort to your mother tongues. And you see, Eliezer ben Yehuda, who was the father of Israeli, so to speak, he wanted very much to speak like a biblical Jew. He wanted very much to speak like an Arab. He saw the Arab as the enviable Semite who rides the biblical camel and enters the biblical kind of walls of Jerusalem and saying ka and ha and ah. By the way, we don't have ha in Israeli. We say ch, like Aachen in German. We don't have this expectoration. You know, if you expectorate as a Semite, you need to learn to expectorate. To expectorate means to say this sound that we do not say, but the Arabs, they do say, like ana bahibak, you know, I love you. So you have this huh that we do not have. Eliezer ben Yehuda really wanted to speak like an Arab, but he could not get rid of his European, Yiddish, Germanic mindset. And this is the irony of history, that he kind of hated Yiddish because it was the diasporic language of the feminine, homosexual, in quotation marks, kind of feeble, persecuted, weak Jew, and Zionism wanted very much to be strong, like a Samsonite, like David, you know, like strong and independent and no, irreligious. It was a secular movement, let's not forget about it. And there was this kind of return to Canaan. I actually see Zionism and Canaanite tradition, which is another kind of political movement within Israel, is very similar in two components. One, the negation of the diaspora, and two, the negation of religion. So Zionism wanted to say, we are atheists, we are secular, we do not care about the diasporic religious Jew. But the irony, as I said earlier, is that it failed. In other words, we do speak like Yiddish speakers. We have an intonation of Yiddish, etc. So this is to answer the first question that you asked about how I teach Bangla. I teach Bangla telling them exactly what it sounded like. For example, Bangla.
How do you know?
But I know. What?
How do you know?
How do I know? I know exactly as I know that Latin viva voce, as pronounced in Oxford, was pronounced actually viva voce. How do I know that? You know, viva voce is the oral examination that we have in Oxford. When I told somebody when I had my PhD or DPhil, doctor of philosophy examination in Oxford, I said, I'm going to my Wiwa Woke. He looked at me as if I just crawled from under a stone, like I was kind of a Philistine. What do you mean, Wiwa Woke? You mean Viva Bosi? This is how you should pronounce it in Oxford, Viva Bosi. But I know that it was Wiwa Woke because I know Latin and Romance languages.
Just quickly,
and I know
what does it mean? Viva Voce.
Wiwa Woke means live, kind of live voice, meaning oral examination.
Okay.
So you have you submit your DPhil thesis, and then you have an oral examination, which in Oxford it's called Viva Voce. VIVAVOCE. Mm-hmm. Now in Germany, probably you would say Viva Voce, but I know it was Wiwa Woke. Now how do we know? Because we reconstruct with other Romance languages. In the case of Bangla, I reconstruct Bangla with other Thura-Yura languages. Thura-Yura or Thura-Yura are languages in which the word for man or person is either Yura or Thura. These are these languages. And I can tell you that in other languages, we also have these retroflexes. We have three R's. We have an R like in English, like this R. We have an R like in Italian and like in Hebrew that we do not pronounce in Israeli, by the way. Mm-hmm. And we have this kind of flappy R like in Japanese Subaru, this or in American when they say T, wada, this kind of R. So we have baru. So three different R's. But of course, for Klamor Wilhelm Schumann, who was a German speaker, there was only one R. He could not, I mean, he knew that it sounded different, but he could not really consistently say when it was R, when it was R, because when you are German speaking, either you are, say, from Bayern and you say R, you know, like all the time, or you're from another, so you say R all the time. You cannot, I mean, you don't have a minimal pair of R and R, right? You cannot tell me. Like R means one thing and R means another thing, you know? So the same comes here. So I teach the Bangla people how to pronounce it originally, but I know that that would not actually catch on. I know in advance what is revivable and what is unrevivable. So for example, the verbal system or the verbs are revivable. Like if you look at Israeli, you can say that, you know, we use morphology that often is Hebrew with this kind of non-concatenative consonants. So we kind of put, say, p-t-r. So we have several possibilities when it comes to verb patterns. We have piter, or piter means fired. Putar was fired, patar exempted, niftar passed on or died, hiftir said the haftarah, which is the section from the Bible that you need to say when you go to the synagogue, for example, in your bar mitzvah, huftar, hitpater, resigned. We even have hitputar, which means he was forced. So hitputar means he resigned, knowing that if he did not resign, he would be fired. So hitputa. We have all these possibilities with the verbal and now with the verbal patterns, with the verb patterns. But what is interesting, even about the root of Israeli, and this to answer your question very specifically, we actually continue the stem that you have in German. So in German, you can have spricht, sprechen, or sprechen, sprach, gesprochen, spruch, I-E-A-O-U. And you change the meaning a little bit, but of course the stem is spr and then vowel and then ch, spruch. In Israeli, following this kind of train of thought, we have the same thing. So for example, a word like click, like to click the mouth, I use the verb pattern iklik, ifil. So I say iklik, ani iklakti, and the reason is that I want to maintain the stem of click, which is kl vowel, it doesn't matter which vowel, and then k. So just like spricht, sprechen, sprach, gesprochen, spruch, I have clicky, clicky, klakti, and a click, or transfer. You know, there was a guy called Gandhi or Rehavam Zeevi. His name was Gandhi not because he was a peacenik, but rather because he looked a little bit like Mahatma Gandhi. He didn't have hair, he was thin in the army, etc. And he said, צריך לטרנספר את הערבים. So we need to transfer the Arabs. Transfer meaning to move people, right? To displace people. Now, he was a right winger. Now, le transfer does not really have a root. It has a stem, and the stem is tr, and then nsfr. So in other words, I say, I decide to use the PL verb pattern because this is the only verb pattern that retains the what we call the prosodic structure of this stem. And the prosodic structure is that after the tr, you have a vowel, then you have nsfr, and then you have a vowel, and then rr. So for example, we say transferti, I transferred in the past, ani metransfer, I am transferring now, and ani atransfer, I will transfer. So I maintain, I keep, I retain this prosodic structure of the stem. So this is actually very similar to the Germanic languages, like Yiddish and German, rather than to the Semitic languages. So even in the morphology of Israeli, which is reclaimed Hebrew, there is a lot of European components. So I would argue that any language reclamation is expected to end up as a hybrid, as a cross-fertilized kind of collection of species. Now, there is nothing wrong with that. I think that this is the beauty of language revival. It results in a new type of diversity. And I am not about, I'm not going to chastise and to kind of say to the Israeli speakers or the Bangla speakers, you don't know how to speak it properly. You should speak according to the academy. No, I think that the native speaker is the king. The native speaker is, or the queen. So we need, as linguists, to describe what the native speakers love, rather than to chastise and to tell them how to speak properly.
Yeah, it's much more motivational as well. Like, it's much more motivational. Okay, so now you're almost there, then no, it's still wrong. No, it's still wrong. You're mispronouncing that, even though that might be something that is not fixable for that person at all.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You're very right. And you know, at the beginning, when I came to Australia, as I said earlier, like, people asked me, oh, you Jews, you're so clever. How do you speak the language of Isaiah, you know, like as it used to be? Some people told me, we are not as clever as you. It was kind of, they were deterred. But then I told them, look, we do not speak the language of Isaiah exactly as it used to be. Speak the language of Isaiah Leibovitz, you know, the philosopher from the 20th century. We do not speak the language of Isaiah, or Isaiah Berlin, if you want, but he didn't know Israeli that much. But we do not speak the language of Ishayahu.
So who's that?
Isaiah Berlin was a friend from Oxford. His name was Isaiah Berlin, just like Berlin.
Okay, so that's a personal friend of yours.
Yeah, he was. He died, unfortunately. Okay. I attended his funeral in Oxford, in Kidlington. It was a very small funeral. He was a philosopher who translated Russian philosophy into English in the 20th century, Isaiah Berlin. He did not speak Israeli, but he knew some Hebrew. We discussed a lot the Hebrew revival and, you know, philosophy and stuff like that. But the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, there were seven Jews who changed the world. There was Moses, who said everything is in the head. Actually, there were eight Jews who changed the world. Eight. So Moses said everything is in the head. Jesus said everything is in the heart. Mark said everything is in the stomach. I don't know if you see my stomach. The Freud said everything is in the loin. Then you have, well, Zuckerman, this is me. Everything is in the tongue.
So you're one of the eight.
What?
You're one of the eight Jews that changed the world.
Right. Zuckerberg. No, this is because you have Zuckerberg. He said everything is online. Mm-hmm. Then you have the cleverest, Einstein. Everything is relative. And then you have a Seinfeld who says, not that there is anything wrong with that. You know, he says it with regard, I don't know. Now, not that there is anything wrong with that is exactly what I wanted to say to you now. When we claim that any language revival results in a hybrid, now I should say, not that there is anything wrong with that. I think that there is nothing wrong with being a hybrid. I think that we should change this kind of puristic imprisoning prism of thinking, you know, that we need everything to be pure. Let us not forget that when we talk about purity, we idealize the original language. For example, Proto-Indo-European, you know, it was not pure. It itself was a hybrid, you know, but people say, oh, this is Proto-Indo-European. So we have this idealized kind of notion of the Ursprache, you know, the Ursprache of Indo-European, the proto-language of Indo-European was kind of perfect. It was pure. Of course, it's rubbish. Now, there was a clever guy called Gotthelf Bergstresser.
Just quick interruption. I actually think that's what's wrong with language learning. It's this puristic view that either you learn the language perfectly without a mistakes and you speak it like a native, or you don't learn it at all. And also you have that approach in schools where you're drilled to speak the language perfectly rather than just to learn it in general, which means there's just a yes or no. You learn it or you don't. So which means that pretty much everybody doesn't. And so I like that approach. It's like a pragmatic approach to...
I agree with you. Yeah. Even though I would make a distinction between a native speech and a non-native speech. So
yeah, of course.
When I
it's
talk about
levels.
About prescriptivism, I very much am against prescriptivism in the case of native speakers. When it comes to how to learn a language, I'm actually with you, but this is a distinction to be made because the native speaker speaks a language automatically. So you don't need to learn a language that is your mother tongue. You know, in Berlin, any Berliner speaks perfect Berlin Deutsch, and you know, he doesn't need to care about, you know, should I say this or should I say that. I mean, a native speaker never makes mistakes practically, whereas a non-native speaker, then, you know, you have to decide, do you want to be like a native speaker or kind of a pseudo native speaker, or do you just want to communicate? So I'm with you totally in this specific case. Now Bergstresser, Gotthelf Bergstresser, may God help him, he went to Israel in 1928 and he heard what was being spoken. Now, what was being spoken then was exactly the link between what we've just said, you know, the second language and the native language, because the first revivalists, they were not native speakers of Hebrew. Their children, they were actually native speakers of a language that I call Israeli. They got not exactly the same input that, for example, Isaiah the Biblical could have given them, because Eliezer ben Yehuda, even though he knew Biblical Hebrew very well, he was not a native speaker. Now, Bergstresser goes to Israel, and in 1928, he describes the language that he heard. And he said, and with your permission, I will say it in German, because he wrote in German. He said, ein Hebräisch, das in Wirklichkeit eine europäische Sprache in durchsichtige hebräische Verkleidung ist, mit gemeineuropäischen Zügen und einzelsprachlichen Besonderheiten, aber nur ganz äußerlich hebräischem Charakter. In other words, he's saying that what he's hearing is a Hebrew, which in reality is a European language, in transparent Hebrew disguise, with peculiarities of specific European languages and also some characteristics of what I call standard average European. It was not exactly his term, but only with a totally external Hebrew character. So he already in 1928 points out that the language that I call Israeli, he called it, I don't know what, was not exactly the language of Isaiah. Now, this is a German a person who comes, a linguist, a philologist, who comes and listens and compares it to what he studies as Hebraic, you know, which is obviously not Israeli. I mean, when you study Hebrew in Germany as a priest or as a philologist, you usually study the Bible, you don't, or the Mishnah, you don't study Israeli. And it's very, very interesting, this kind of tension that happened already. It was known already at the beginning of the 20th century. Even Eliezer ben Yehuda himself, and this is something that I have discovered recently, reflects on this and says, you know, maybe it's not exactly what I want, etc. So he really wanted to speak like Isaiah. But it was impossible for him to do that, simply because we do not have this Babel fish, you know, like we do not have this kind of, we cannot inject the language into our brain, which might be in the future, but currently we cannot do that. So that's something to remember.
And then after discussing the first problem in depth, what about the second one? What to do with words that don't exist? Do you just use the English words, or what do you do with them?
So in the case of Israeli, in the case of Bangla, it's very simple. We began neologizing words, so neologization, or making, coining new words, concocting neologisms. For example, we coined the word for computer, Gaga Bibi Waribirga. Gaga means head. Bibi is an egg. So Gaga Bibi is the brain. It's the egg within the head. And Waribirga is a lightning. So Gaga Bibi brain, Waribirga lightning. So it's a lightning brain or electric brain, computer. So this is an example. Or for example, there was a word for beanie. You know, beanie is something you put like that. It's like a hat. And so we decided to call it Ganu Ganu Muna. Ganu Ganu means comfortable, warm, and Muna means cap. So Ganu Ganu Muna is beanie.
So you speak that language fluently, right?
Well, I mean, I am currently the one who knows the language best, but I'm not a native speaker, of course. So I teach the Bangla their own language, but with the hope that one Bangla will come and lead and study linguistics and revivalistics and lead the revival instead of me, because I'm a facilitator. I'm a revivalist. I am not a Bangla Aboriginal person myself. I want to give the leadership to a Bangla person. So of course we do everything together, but I'm the only linguist, and you must have a linguist or a revivalist, a professional revivalist, when you reclaim a language. You cannot just do it. It's not, this is the difference between acquiring your native tongue, which you don't need to be a linguist, you just listen to your parents, and of course reclaiming a Sleeping Beauty, where you need a linguist. So unfortunately we don't have a Bangla linguist so far.
Are there any native speakers yet? Fluent speakers. Besides,
not yet. Look, okay. The Hebrew Bible took 50 years. And by the way, I mean, it's the Aboriginal decision how far they would like to go. We can go full Monty. I mean, native speakers, these will be the grandchildren. We can also go, you know, like post-vernacularly. So post-vernacular stage is that, well, we know 100 words. You know, a little bit like many Maori are post-vernacular. They know how to say whakapapa, which means genealogy, or whanau, which means family. A little bit like Yiddish speakers in America, they know how to say mishpoche, which means family. They know how to say schlep, you know, like to come from here, to take it from here. But they do not actually speak Yiddish, you know, so it's post-vernacular. So this is for identity purposes. The Bangla people can decide, okay, we want to conduct all the ceremonies in language, funerals, welcome to country. We want to change the landscape, the linguistic landscape of Eyre Peninsula, where Bangla is. And so it is for them to decide how far they would like to go. Yeah. You have many Bangla today who can understand many things, etc. But we still do not have native speakers. No, we do not have.
How big is that group?
It's a very small group, just like every language in Australia. So just to give you an idea, in Australia, we had 330 languages, as I said earlier, and only 660,000 Aboriginal people. So 2,000 people per language. So you have 1,000 Bangla people.
And how many were there before the British?
Same.
The same.
So 2,000, yeah.
So it's basically the same, like the same size of a group as there was before that would speak that language.
Yes. So a little bit less, I have to say, but Aboriginal people, by and large, these days have many children. So anything that was lost is kind of reacquired. But many Aboriginal people are assimilated and mixed. So therefore, it depends how you count it. I mean, if you count it by the number of people who feel Aboriginal, which is in fact what the counting should be like, then we have approximately 660,000 Aboriginal people, which is similar to the number of Aboriginal people that were around before colonization. And so if you do the calculation, 660,000 divided by 330, you see 2,000 people per language.
Is that
So it's
enough? Sorry.
different.
Is that enough to revitalize a language in a globalized world, in a very connected world in Australia? Like I'm guessing they're not isolated from the rest of Australia. So is that even realistic with such a small group of people in today's world, in today's world?
Well, firstly, let me quote Margaret Mead. She was a controversial anthropologist, an American one. And she said, never doubt that a small group of people can change the world. In fact, it is always the case that a small group of people change. So, in other words, look, this is on the one hand. On the other hand, and let me answer in a Jewish way, on the other hand, you're right. I mean, if you do not have a national kind of a state, a nationhood movement, as you had in Israel, it'll be hard for you. So it's not exactly the number of people, but it's the national component. In the case of Israel, there was an ideology. This will be the language of the future state of the Jews, So you had a lot of ideology. Here, it is more about well-being. It is more about identity. It is more about the fact that, it might improve, and this is something that I'm currently looking at, whether language reclamation improves the mental health of people, and I believe so. So it's about that, not just about kind of, okay, we will have a state where everything will be conducted in language, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, look, it's a small group, but in the Talmud they say even, if you help one person, if you save one person, it's like you save the entire world, So it's kind of maximus in minimis, like the bigger picture of the world would be better if you help kind of a small in the micro. So I believe in the micro, in the macro, and in the mucro. If you look at the massive, at the MOOC, at the massive open online course, but I think that it's very important to realize that yeah, it is small. We are not going to influence here millions of people, but we can actually set an example for millions of people, because you have millions of people all over the world who would like to reconnect with their heritage. And I believe, and this might be wishful thinking, that with the technological revolution, we will actually change from seeking things to seeking ideas. Don't forget that the Industrial Revolution changed people from seeking food to seeking things. Because with the Industrial Revolution, I can do one thing and pay to buy food. I don't need to be a farmer. In the past, 90% of Germany were farmers. Nowadays, what, 4% maybe are farmers. So this is the Industrial Revolution. Now, the technological revolution, in my view, will turn people from seeking things to seeking ideas. And this is when language revival will become much more prevalent than it is today. Today, language revival is considered weird. It's considered kind of, why should we revive a language? Let's just talk English. Everybody will be happy. There'll be no wars. And, I mean, people just forget about Rwanda. They forget about Syria, unfortunately. In Rwanda and in Syria, the people who are killing each other, they speak, or in Rwanda, they killed, not anymore. They spoke and they speak the very same language. In Syria, people kill each other, they speak the same dialect. So, I am kind of not, I don't believe that if everybody speaks only one language, there'll be no wars anymore. On the contrary, I think that the more diversity, the happier people are with their heritage, the happier the society, the more harmonious the society will be. So this is why I believe in language revival, especially in the case of languages that were subject to linguicide, language killing, or glottophagy, language eating. So another language ate them.
I know there's so much more to discuss, and I see how you're super passionate about that topic,
Look,
but I guess there, like, I saw your talk on the at the Polyglot conference, so I think it will be interesting for anybody that wants to find out more about this topic. And the MOOC, the course that you teach, people can find it on edX, right? And
Yes, edX, edX,
edX,
edX. Yeah, we call it
exactly.
edX.
So maybe some more resources for people that want to find out more, because I
Yeah,
feel like we
absolutely.
could talk for hours more, but at some point.
Well, look, I mean, if I may, I would like to end up with a very good quotation that I love by Friedrich Nietzsche. Because you told me that there will be some German speakers who are going to watch this interview.
Yeah,
And
mostly.
Friedrich Nietzsche in Die Morgenröte, which is the dawn, in I think 1881 or 1882, I think around that time he published. And I remember reading it in the German. I studied German in order to read Nietzsche. He said, "Alle Dinge, die lange leben, werden allmählich so mit Vernunft durchtränkt, dass ihre Abkunft aus der Unvernunft dadurch unwahrscheinlich wird. Klingt nicht fast jede genaue Geschichte einer Entstehung für das Gefühl paradox und frevelhaft? Whatever lives long is gradually so saturated with reason that its irrational origins become improbable. Does not almost every accurate history of the origin of something sound paradoxical and sacrilegious to our feelings? When I revive a language and when I talk about the Israeli language, I often feel exactly that, that I'm trying to show, firstly, that language revival is wonderful, as opposed to people who believe that, we should all speak one language and then there'll be nothing wrong. I mean, they don't think about things that they should think about, like Rwanda and Syria. But also when I talk about the hybridization, the cross-fertilization of the Israeli language, which does not deter me from reviving other languages, then people say, "Oh, what are you telling us that we do not speak pure Hebrew? I mean, we are already brainwashed to believe that we speak pure Hebrew. Why are you giving us the new kind of facts to confuse us?" So I actually feel kind of resorting to Nietzsche, 1882, and other sources that are available are, for example, other than the MOOC, Language Revival, Securing the Future of Endangered Languages, and other than a beautiful Babbel, Babbel, I think they're based in Berlin too, or at least they have made a beautiful kind of, it was a spontaneous interview, just like this one in Greece, in Thessaloniki, and they asked me about the three reasons to reclaim a language, something that we did not discuss. But I think that this is something to watch. They made an animation, a textual animation clip with it. I think it's only 4 or 5 minutes, and this is something to look up. So Babbel and my name Zuckerman, which is a German spelling with double N and CK. My ancestors were probably sugar daddies, and then you have other, if you go and you put Bangla, Bangarla, you'll find a lot of material. There is a bangla.com, and then if you go zuckerman.org, zuckerman.org, I pronounce Zuckerman like the Australians, although it is Zuckerman. So the German pronunciation is exactly the Israeli pronunciation, Zuckerman. Almost the same. I mean, maybe in Germany it's a little bit like Zuckerman, like Zuckerman. Whereas we say
Zuckerman.
Zuckerman, Zuckerman, yeah. I think that in German it's the R becomes more like ah, like Zuckerman. Whereas
Zuckerman.
in Israeli it's Zuckerman, Zuckerman. So the vowel is more E in Israeli than in German, So look, I mean, there is a lot of material out there. If you write revivalistics, Zuckerman, Bangala, MOOC, endangered languages, Adelaide, Israel, you'll end up finding more resources.
Great. Well, thank you so much. It was a great pleasure.
Thank you so much, Gabriel. It's wonderful talking to you. And anytime, I would be very happy to talk to you. And yeah.
Sure, at some future polyglot gathering, conference, whatever.
Exactly.